WHQR Public Media. In Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Critical race theory, it's been around since the 1970s, but it's recently found its way into state legislatures across the country. And it's turned up at the center of political firestorms over what should be legal to teach in schools. A bill moving through the North Carolina state legislature doesn't name critical race theory, but House Bill 324 states in part that public schools shall not promote the concept that an individual, solely by virtue of his or her race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously, or, it goes on, that a person bears responsibility for actions committed in the past by other members of the same race or sex. Entitled Ensuring Dignity and Non-Discrimination in Schools, the bill also says no one should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress due to his or her race or sex. And it seeks to exclude from school curricula the idea that the United States, as a meritocracy, is an inherently racist or sexist belief, or that this country was created by members of a particular race or sex for the purpose of oppressing members of another race or sex. Earlier this year, the New Hanover County Republican Party held a demonstration protesting the use of a consultant in the public school system that would, according to the school system, promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. According to the local GOP, the consultant, funded by taxpayer dollars, would promote harmful ideas, like those outlined in House Bill 324, promoting racism and indoctrinating young people. Now the New Hanover County GOP is organizing a new initiative called Kids First Alliance to challenge the Board of Education to prevent the introduction of critical race theory or related curriculum into the schools of New Hanover County. The local GOP describes critical race theory this way, quote, the bigotry of low expectations of black children, end quote. My guest today comes at critical race theory from an academic point of view. Kimberly Cook is a professor of sociology and criminology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is also the director of the Restorative Justice Collaborative at UNCW. Professor Cook, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much.
Now, we heard a lot about the opponents of critical race theory and what they're saying is embedded in that idea. They're also quoting the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in The Pursuit of Colorblindness and the fulfillment of his dream that one day we will be judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. So this opposition to critical race theory, it sounds like it's simply opposition to bigotry. Can you explain what critical race theory is from an academic point of view?
Sure. Critical race theory is a tool that people in scholarly research and in teaching will use this tool to explain and elaborate how we got into the predicament of racial injustices in the United States. Sometimes it's generalized to the entire United States in terms of our whole entire U.S. history. Sometimes it's specific to a particular location or a particular region's history or current practices as well. I think the main point of critical race theory as a tool is that we didn't get into this predicament accidentally. We got into this situation because people in the past made choices and institutions function in a way that reinforce their profits, reinforce their capacity to engage in influence within the community and within the society and the state and the nation. So critical race theory really began in legal studies and then expanded beyond there to explore how systems of power function to maintain white supremacist practices across society. It's beyond an individual's intention, and it's beyond an individual's sole unique responsibility. It's about our social patterns.
It's interesting you use the language, this predicament that we find ourselves in, and we are in this situation because we haven't attended to the moral obligation of righting the wrong. What predicament are we in?
Well, we're in a predicament of compounded, complex racial injustices that have been going on for centuries in this country, 400 and some years. We have had a series of recent events in our country that have exposed many of the wounds that have been unhealed in our country regarding race and racism. We have had a number of people in positions of influence and authority calling for efforts to repair those harms through reparations or reconciliation efforts or some other capacity to acknowledge the harm. We just simply had the 100th anniversary today of the Tulsa massacre. Wilmington, of course, is home to the 1898 massacre and coup, and we're also the home of the disastrous issues regarding school desegregation in the 1970s and the Wilmington 10. So,
well, can we take those issues?
There's a lot to unpack.
Yes, and many of those we've talked about on this program, what they are, what the history of those issues are. Is it fair to say, though, that all of them are in the past and people would like to move forward with possibility instead of dwelling on past harms that are no longer here? They were terrible, but they don't exist anymore.
They do exist, though. The pain of it still exists, right? And so the trauma of it exists. I am a trauma researcher. I do grounded theory research. And the impact of those legacies of historical trauma continue to cause agony and upset and pain and oppression and lack of opportunities and lack of available resources to people who are in need and continue to be in pain as a consequence of that history and that current predicament.
And it's interesting when you were explaining critical race theory from an academic point of view, you were saying that it's about looking at systems and laws.
Yes.
It's not about figuring out which individuals are the most culpable for some of these past wrongs.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's about looking at the systems that have been established over centuries in this country that have produced the kind of inequality that we're seeing. We do not live in a meritocracy. The notion that we do live exclusively in a meritocracy is, I think, really an unfortunate myth. In fact, my colleagues at UNCW, Steve McNamee and Rob Miller, wrote a book called The Myth of Meritocracy, which is all about this fiction that we tell ourselves that we live in a world where anybody can pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Well, not everybody has boots, right? So we need to make sure that what we're talking about is historically accurate. And this concept of exclusive meritocracy is not the truth of where our society is or how we got here.
When we look at some of the bullet points that the New Hanover County Republican Party lays out as its opposition to critical race theory, these are points that it's really hard to argue with, and you can find these on their website. Number one says, if you are Black, you're being held back because of white supremacy. You can't succeed. Now, if that's true, that is, I mean, that takes away all the power and all, you know, anything an individual, the dynamism of the individual could bring to the potential in his or her life.
Right.
That sounds like a terrible prison and a terrible thing to teach children.
Well, it's also historically accurate to point out that there are historical disadvantages. There's a lot of statistical evidence around the lack of opportunity and lack of cultivation of young children of color. I mean, we see a lot of good information, dependable statistical information regarding the school to prison pipeline, where we know that the disciplinary practices in many schools, and I'm glad to say here in New Hanover County, there's a broad scale commitment to reversing that problem, where children, particularly children of color, are more likely to be suspended and expelled from school and then funneled into the school to prison pipeline, partly because of implicit biases, not because the teachers necessarily have an explicit bias against children of color, but because children of color are perceived to be more obnoxious or more troublesome or more involved in, you know, disciplinary infractions, when in fact the statistical evidence shows that white kids and kids of color engage in about the same amount of disruptive behavior in school, but kids of color end up suspended and expelled more frequently. We are addressing that, thanks in large part, to Judge Korpening, and New Hanover County Schools are really interested in trying to combat the school-to-prison pipeline. So, you know, the predicament that we're in is a predicament of opportunity, a predicament of perception, a predicament of doing things the way we've always done things is going to get us where we've always been, right? So we need to upgrade our efforts to make sure that we actually do have a fair society. And I applaud the language of fairness and non-discrimination. The strategy to get there, we can debate. And I am not trying to pick a fight with any Republicans, because being a Republican is a perfectly valid political identity, and being a Democrat is a perfectly valid political identity, and we can have a conversation.
You're listening to Coastline. We're taking a closer look at critical race theory, what it actually is, and why it's suddenly the center of a local and national political firestorm. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Critical race theory is a dangerous concept teaching bigotry, the powerlessness of the individual, and the idea that the United States was founded on evil. That's according to opponents of the theory. But my guest today says, as a professor of sociology and criminology at UNCW, she's used it for years to inform her work. Professor Kimberly Cook is also the director of the Restorative Justice Collaborative at UNCW. And Professor Cook, before we went to break, you were separating the idea of pointing fingers at individuals versus looking at systems and laws that keep oppression in place for people of color in this country. And you mentioned implicit bias playing out in schools through teachers. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about that? And are white teachers just born into some kind of systemic prejudice that causes them to, where does this implicit bias come from, and how can we work our way out of it?
So the system of cultural practices that we call the system of implicit biases is a set of cultural norms, beliefs, values, and attitudes that we are all exposed to. Tim Tyson, author of Blood Done Signed My Name and many other wonderful books at Duke University, refers to us all swimming in the sea of white supremacy, whether we know it or not. And some of us have an easier time staying afloat, and others of us drown. The sea of white supremacy is a sea of ideas and images. Our pop cultural messages are often pop cultural messages that reproduce the implicit biases of the stranger as a danger, particularly the strangers of color who are perceived and portrayed as being somehow more dangerous and more violent and more likely to harm us. And so the system of implicit bias is part of a cultural pattern around fear-mongering in some cases, and just an aversion toward people because you have been taught that those people are not to be trusted or not safe for whatever reason. And so we often have implicit biases. They're the knee-jerk reactions. They're the kind of reactions that occur in the base of your brainstem. So it's not something that's in your prefrontal cortex where you're actually thinking through an event. It's just this knee-jerk reaction that you sometimes have to people or to events or to moments. And the implicit bias is not something necessarily that we think through until we can see that this is a pattern within ourselves. And so Harvard University has an implicit association test. If anybody wants to go online at Harvard and look at the implicit association test and test themselves to see where their own implicit biases lie. And implicit biases can impact our views around race and racism, as well as our views around gender and gender equality, our views around LGBTQ individuals and people who are trans individuals. And so all of the ways in which we can exhibit an implicit bias can be tested on that implicit association test, if anybody wants to try that.
So you're saying it's an unconscious filter. We don't even know, as Tim Tyson said, we don't even know that we're wet. We don't even know that we're viewing the world through that lens.
Right.
Because it's hard to see that without having it pointed out to us.
Because we've been saturated in it for so long.
And I don't like to think, though, that I can look at another human and just immediately have all these snap judgments, most of which are probably negative. I don't want to think that about myself.
Well, okay. You don't have to think that about yourself, but it may in fact be true sometimes. You know, I have implicit biases. We all have them. We have individual, I think, patterns of implicit biases. And so I think we need to take responsibility for how we engage with people and how we understand each other in our communities.
One of the points that the new Hanover County GOP articulates as being a reason that critical race theory is dangerous indoctrination of our kids, it says, this makes our founding principles evil. You should not love this country. How do we reconcile the origins of this country and the fact that it was built on the institution of slavery and our love for this country? Are those two things reconcilable?
It's painful. It's a painful process. I am a descendant of colonizers in Massachusetts. I'm not a Mayflower descendant. My ancestors were on the next boat. The colony of Massachusetts established the first law in 1641 authorizing enslavement, called the Body of Liberties. And my ancestors were part of that. My ancestors came in and did horrendous things to indigenous people, engaged in crimes against humanity and set up systems of exclusion and exclusionary practices, engaged in brutality and murder of indigenous people, and enslaved indigenous people as well as enslaved African people. My 8 times great-grandfather, Samuel Edson, died in 1719 and bequeathed his Negro slave, Sarah, to his daughter, Susanna, and his Negro slave, George, to his son, Samuel Edson, who was my 7 times great-grandfather. It's hard to see that in our history. And in order for that bequeath of property, human property, to occur, there has to be a system in place to validate the legality of that transaction. It was a system of laws that was authorized that people who look like me could dehumanize other people who don't look like me.
And when you say look like you,
meaning I'm white, right? We consider ourselves white, which is, of course, according to critical race theory, is a social construct, right? So the notion, while we do have, this is a sidebar, while we do have variation in pigmentation, genetic variation in pigmentation of our skin, the meaning that our society makes of those variations is considered a social construct. It's a story we tell ourselves about race that is only a story, and since it was set up as a narrative, it can be deconstructed as a narrative as well. We can tell ourselves a better story. We can tell ourselves a more inclusive story. We can tell ourselves a story that we're all human, and therefore we are all entitled to human rights, and we are all entitled to the vibrancy of a human and dignified life. And so therefore we should have access to, families, and our families should not be torn apart by slavery. Our families should not be sold on the auction block. Our families should not be dismembered. Our families should not be, sold up the river and taken into slavery or slaughtered in the town square simply because they're indigenous people. So, I mean, this is what my ancestors did. I know their names. I know what they did. And this is the system that they set up. And it's painful.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to ask you how you feel about that. How does that inform your life today? How do you think about it? Do you hate your ancestors? Do you think they're evil people?
I think they were engaged in practices based on beliefs, that cultural belief system that they embraced at the time. But I also think they knew it was wrong, morally wrong, and they did it anyway. If you want to look for evidence of how wrong they knew it was, look at all of the publications that theologians wrote to justify it. If it wasn't wrong, then why would they need to write so much justifying it? So when we talk about the history of this, it becomes personal. I feel a personal obligation to undo the damage that my ancestors created by setting up the systems that are in place that deliberately harm people that I care about.
Do you feel guilt or shame about this?
I feel anger. I feel responsible to undo the harm. It's not guilt so much as sadness, grief, regret. It's not shame in the sense of I'm ashamed of my ancestors. I am grieved by the damage they caused other people and other people who were wanting to live their lives to the best of their ability, to live their lives, to enjoy creativity, to enjoy their innovation, to benefit from their talents and their hard work. And yet they couldn't benefit from their hard work because their hard work was taken over by someone else that didn't do the hard work themselves. And so, or did different hard work. So I just think that it's really complicated and it's really painful when you really dig deep into your genealogy and you see what your ancestors did. I also have ancestors who were abolitionists, and I have ancestors. My fourth great-grandfather fought in the American Revolution, Eli Cook. And, my third great-grandfather fought in the War of 1812. You know, so there's some really interesting people in our genealogies if you look for it. But we can't look at our genealogy simply for the good things that our ancestors did. We also have to look at our genealogy for the tales they tell of how we got here. And how we got here has not been a smooth and easy path for anybody. So it's hard. And the systems that they created were systems that were meant to maintain an advantage by people who are considered white.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring critical race theory since it's become the center of a political firestorm, both nationally and at the local level. My guest today is Kimberly Cook. She's a professor of sociology and criminology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and she's the director of the Restorative Justice Collaborative. at UNCW. I want to look at some of the language that's in this House Bill 324 that I think is sitting in the Rules Committee, but has gone through several incarnations. And it talks about, I don't think it ever states that it's discussing critical race theory, but it talks about how an individual solely by virtue of his or her race or sex can't be held accountable for past actions of the people of the same race or sex. And this language was interesting to me. And this is why I asked you about how you feel about your ancestors. It says an individual solely by virtue of his or her race or sex, and this is something that cannot be taught in schools, should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress. This seems to be so much of what the opposition to discussing systems of oppression, to looking at white supremacy with open eyes is about. Several years ago, when we started talking about Confederate monuments here and whether they should be in the public arena, at the end of that show, someone said to me, a white person said to me, "I'm just so tired of getting beaten over the head mm-hmm. with this stuff and being made to feel like I'm awful because I'm white." And I think there are a lot of people that feel that way. Is there anything that you can say to kind of, I mean, there is just so much resistance to being made to feel bad, guilt, shame, anguish about this.
Yeah, so
is that a misunderstanding?
No, I think it's a complicated situation. And the resentment that people feel if they are told that, you know, they have white privilege and they don't see themselves as having white privilege is a consequence of, I think, people wanting to understand but not being not being able to fully see the, or maybe not ready to see how complex the interrelationship is that we who are considered white have with the systems of advantages that we take for granted. It is invisible to us often. You know, Peggy McIntosh talks about the invisible knapsack of privilege. And if we don't know that we have privilege and we're told or taught that we have to now acknowledge that we have privilege, it can feel like a really painful and maybe offensive confrontation. The systems of advantages that have been set up have been, I think, taken for granted by people who are white or consider ourselves white without really understanding that they are advantages that other people who are people of color do not have access to or as much access to. You know, some people do, but not everybody does. And so the advantages that I get on the basis of my racial or ethnic identity are advantages that people that I love and care about who happen to be people of color don't get to access. So for example, when I go to the grocery store and I'm using a credit card, I don't very often have to show ID, right? And I almost never get stopped by police, almost never. I'm a 60-year-old white woman, right? It just doesn't happen, which I hope continues. maybe I shouldn't have jinxed
myself. But if you
myself.
Were stopped by police, would you have a different experience than a person of color in this country?
I'd probably be super polite and internally annoyed. I would comply, of course, but I wouldn't be afraid for my life.
And that goes to another point in opposition to what we're calling critical race theory, a part of this indoctrination of our young people that the local GOP is resisting. And that is the idea that policing is systemically racist. There are so many good law enforcement officers.
Yes.
Really, really good people.
Yes.
Who went into it because they wanted to help. They
yes.
wanted to serve the public. And now it almost seems like that the entire profession, of which, you know, that used to be a point of pride,
yes.
is just getting trashed.
So the notion of policing is meant to be a service to the community. I've traveled a fair amount in other countries, and in Australia, it's not called a police force, it's called a police service, because it's about service to the community. And so the work of police officers is to ensure public safety and to serve the public in times of distress and to attend to people in need. Police officers are seeing people usually in the worst moments of their lives, in the midst of a crisis or in the midst of a trying and stressful circumstance. And so that is not a good recipe for everybody always making the right decisions in the moment, and including the people whose needs they are attending to. I had a conversation with a woman this morning who's a dear friend of mine and an African-American woman, and she was telling me about a recent personal crisis that she went through that involved the police coming to her assistance. It was a car crash, and so the police came to her assistance. And she said that they were incredibly helpful, very conscientious. They told her everything they were doing before they were doing it. It was like a picture-perfect interaction for a Black woman with a police officer. And they were white police officers. And so she was relieved that it went well. But inside, even though everything went smoothly inside, she still felt that anxiety because anything could go wrong without warning. And it was hard.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of critical race theory, and we're going to talk about restorative justice, what that really means, with UNCW professor Kimberly Cook when we come back after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're taking a closer look at critical race theory, why state legislatures around the country, including the North Carolina General Assembly, are considering banning it from use in school curricula and administration. And we're looking at whether it actually promotes bigotry, as opponents claim. My guest today is sociology and criminology professor Kimberly Cook of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's also the director of UNCW's recently established Restorative Justice Collaborative. Tell us about the Restorative Justice Collaborative. What is it, and when did it come into being?
The Restorative Justice Collaborative was established in January of 2021, and it is a culmination of years of work that many of us in the community have been engaging in to promote restorative practices in the community. This includes the kind of work that I've been able to do in the public schools. That grows out of a conversation, a lunch conversation I had with Judge Korpening and Judy Stubblefield from the administration office in New Hanover County Public Schools, where we decided we really wanted to invest more effort and training in restorative practices, and so we offered more training. We had some colleagues come from Campbell Law School, John Powell and Joya Powell, to come and do some training with us. And since then, I've been kind of a restorative justice coach, and my students work in the community and various agencies. And of course, then we have nonprofit organizations like LINC, where I serve on the board of directors, and communities and schools of the Cape Fear, Step Up Wilmington, Vantage Point, where we've had opportunities to really build and expand restorative capacity in the community. So that's what's been happening. What it is an opportunity for people who have experienced harm and people who have caused harm to have a conversation about the impact, about the events, and about how they can make amends, and how the person who caused the harm can make amends to the person who was harmed. And so it really is about creating a dialogue rather than creating a punishment system. And it's not exclusive of punishment, but it generally does replace the need for punishment when it's done well. And so it's usually slow but responsive and inclusive of the stakeholders who are most directly impacted by the harmful behavior.
Can you give us a specific example of a restorative justice case, a scenario in which people have come together and made a plan for making amends?
I can give you an example, but not from this community, because in this community, we're a small town, and I can't reveal anybody's identity or any issues, and I don't want to report on a case that happened locally because people will hear. So there was a case in Australia, for example, where there was a robbery at a Pizza Hut. And the young man who committed the robbery had a gun, so it was an armed robbery, and he did not intend to, though he did go in with a loaded gun, and he shot and killed one of the workers at the Pizza Hut. The long and the short, I mean, it was a horrible crime. It was a horribly tragic situation. The long and the short of it is, after quite a long time, there was a conversation around restorative practices where the mother of the homicide victim and the man who was responsible for the homicide was in prison for that crime. She, the mother, wanted to have a restorative dialogue with the young man who was responsible because she had questions she wanted to ask him, and she had things she wanted to say to him about how harmful this was to her, how painful it was to lose a child from violent crime and gun violence. So they get into the circle process and they have their dialogue, and everybody's supposed to bring something that represents something important to them. And she brings a Ziploc bag with grass cuttings in it, and she throws it into the center of the room. And she said, "That's all I've got left of my son, is that those are grass clippings from his grave." And that was how that conversation started. And it was just really painful. But in the end, the young man heard her agony and grief and felt the impact of his behavior in ways that he hadn't felt before, which was enlightening to him, and it gave him an opportunity to really see the broader harm that he had caused her. There's many ways in which we can address harms in restorative practices. We can use it in everything from shoplifting to genocide and in between. I will say that in my experience, using restorative practices in cases of severe violence is usually more satisfying to victims and offenders who want to be there than it is going to court, because in a restorative justice process, they're able to share what they have been through and the impact of their behavior and their experiences with each other in ways that they're not able to do in courts generally. And I'm not trying to diminish the importance of courts. I'm just saying it's a different type of process. It's a different platform for having a conversation. The preparation is really important to make sure that there is not going to be additional harms inflicted during the conversation. And so the restorative justice facilitator has to be really conscientious about making sure that the preparation time is good and will not get into a circle dialogue process if there is any risk of additional harms being inflicted on anyone in the circle process. So it's a very careful and deliberate process of bringing people together to have a conversation about how to make amends.
You have talked about restorative justice being one of the ways to restore integrity.
Yes.
Can you talk about what you mean by integrity in that context and why it's important?
So I look at integrity as a way of living intentionally within your value system, right? So I value honesty. And so I try to live honestly. And if there is something that I'm not being honest about, that is a violation of my own integrity, right? And so in restorative practices, what we can do is, because we have that conversation, because we go deep into the things that have harmed other people and harmed each other and the ways in which we take active responsibility for our own behavior, we can resume living within integrity by putting it all out there and saying, I did this. I know it was wrong. I regret that I did this. I especially regret the impact that it had on you because I can see how pained you are by what I did, right? And so living within that sense of integrity, restoring that sense of integrity for somebody who has caused harm is really essential for them to be able to move forward without additional harms that they would later inflict on other people because they're continuing to live in that sense of brokenness.
Can you talk about what, so you, with this example that you used of the young man in Australia mm-hmm. who shot and killed somebody in a Pizza Hut, you talked about him finally understanding kind of the depth and mm-hmm. breadth of the harm that he'd caused. Other than going on a really deep and long and torturous guilt trip, where does that take him besides the guilt?
It gives
shame and anguish.
It gives him an opportunity to repair within himself his own sense of self, and it gives him an opportunity to have a face-to-face conversation to make amends as much as possible to the mother of the young man that he killed. And it gives her a chance to see the regret and the remorse that he generated as a consequence of watching her in agony. And so when people are able to be honest with one another in their deep, difficult emotional condition that they share as a consequence of a violent crime or that they share as a consequence of a harmful behavior that they both endured, one inflicting on the other, then they can resume a relationship with each other as humans, rather than monster, making somebody into a monster or making somebody into a villain. So it really is easier for people to just sort of come face to face. It's emotionally draining. It's a draining on everybody. It's draining on facilitators. It's draining on support people. It's draining on the person who was harmed. It's draining on the person who caused the harm. And the person who caused the harm has an obligation, right? So these people were strangers to each other before it happened. And because of that action, she then became aware of his life and aware of his condition and aware of his progress through the legal system and incarceration. So she always wondered every day what he was doing in prison and what he was getting up to and if he was going to be, you know, getting out soon or whatever, and if anybody was going to inform her. And then he, of course, because of his actions of shooting her son, kept wondering, what is she doing? And I bet she hates me and she'll probably hate me for the rest of her life. And why shouldn't she because of what I did and all of this other stuff? And so for him, his internalized sense of agony that he caused himself and the relationship that forged in this terrible ordeal was a relationship that neither one of them chose, but neither one of them could deny was real because she kept thinking about him and he kept thinking about her. And then having this opportunity to get together and have a conversation in a way that was responsive to her needs and respectful of his predicament being incarcerated meant that he could return to some sense of responsibility and taking active accountability for his behavior in a way that restored his integrity, and she could get answers to questions. Like, she wanted to know why he was conducting that robbery in the first place. Well, he was an addict and he was searching for easy cash. You know, and because of his addiction, her son died.
Yeah, that's an interesting notion that they couldn't deny they had a relationship with each other. I mean, that's the human connection. You're listening to Coastline. Kimberly Cook is with us today. She's a professor of sociology and criminology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's also director of the Restorative Justice Collaborative at UNCW. You are also doing work with an organization called Coming to the Table. This is a national organization with a local Wilmington chapter. What is the mission?
Coming to the Table is a national organization founded by the descendants of Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, and Thomas Jefferson and Martha Jefferson. Incidentally, Martha and Sally were half-sisters. Sally Hemings was his enslaved servant, and with whom he had six children. Of course, we cannot imagine that she was able to provide consent for the sexual relationship because she was enslaved. However, that painful experience of the white descendants denying the existence of the descendants of Sally Hemings also being related to them biologically through Thomas Jefferson was painful, and ultimately DNA confirmed their biological relationship. And they decided they needed to know each other as families. And so they had a big family reunion. They became cousins. They really just embraced each other. Ultimately, they embraced each other. And they decided that if they could do it, then the rest of the country can also move forward with this. And they started the organization Coming to the Table. Coming to the Table is co-directed by Thomas DeWolf, who is descended from the largest slave trading family in North America from Rhode Island, and Jody Geddes, who is an African-American restorative justice woman, facilitator, amazing, intelligent, oh my God, brilliant and inspiring woman in Oakland, California. And the mission of Coming to the Table is to uncover history, to make connections between people and their history, to work toward healing from the racial harms of the legacy of enslavement, and to take action to rectify the inequalities that have shaped our society based on race and racism, and systemic racism in particular. So Coming to the Table, our local chapter, I co-facilitate with Frankie Roberts, thankfully. He's a brilliant leader in our community. And we have monthly meetings, and we often talk about our local history and our local current events and current climate. We have engaged in a variety of different types of public action. We have a petition to encourage city council and county commission to establish a commission for reparations to study and to distribute reparations to victims of the 1898 massacre and coup.
One of the coup d'etats that happened around this country that ousted, we used to say it was the only one on American
soil.
Right,
it's not true.
Right, yeah, we've learned. And ousted duly elected black officials from office and drove many people from their homes and killed an unknown number of people. Just in case, you can find information on our website at whqr.org about the 1898 massacre. So you've asked the city of Wilmington, New Hanover County, to establish a process to study and implement reparations for descendants of victims of the massacre. What have you heard?
Nothing.
What is the Soil Collection Project? And we have less than a minute.
The Soil Collection Project is a cooperative effort with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, to collect soil at the site where people were murdered here in Wilmington in 1898 to commemorate their lives and to establish a living memorial to those victims so that we don't ever forget what happened here and the impact that it's had here.
And when do we expect to see?
The soil collection ceremony is scheduled for November 6th of 2021. And that is being led by Jim Downey and Letty Shoemate and a group of us in the community who are working together to build that program.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Kimberly Cook, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered this episode and had everything to do with it. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or find it on Spotify, Stitcher, or iTunes. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.